Welcome back to Solo Spotlight. I'm your host, Ryan McDougall. In today's episode, we're sitting down with a true pillar of Edmonton's hip-hop story, Arlo Maverick. For over two decades, Arlo's been creating, documenting, and mentoring in ways that go way beyond the music. From his early days in Politic Live that put Edmonton hip-hop on the map, to his solo albums Maybe Tomorrow, Soul Merchant, and most recently, Blue Collar. He's built a career on consistency, community, and pure love for the craft. But Arlo's impact doesn't stop at the mic. He's become a filmmaker, documenting the scene that raised him. He's chairing the Juno Awards Rap Advisory Committee, helping open national doors for Western artists. And he's still mentoring the next generation of Edmonton creatives on how to build something sustainable in an industry that often forgets where it came from. In this episode, we dive deep into that entire journey, from freestyling as a kid on a late-night radio call-in, to navigating family, self-doubt, and reinvention as a solo artist. We talk creative ego, mentorship, and how Arlo's growth mirrors the evolution of this city's culture itself. If you're an artist, a dreamer, or just someone who believes in the grind behind great work, this one's for you. Before we roll the intro, do me a favor, hit subscribe, drop a comment for Arlo, and share this with someone who remembers those early hip-hop days in Edmonton. This is Solo Spotlight Episode 70 with Arlo Maverick.
Welcome to Spare Bedroom Studios, where big sounds are born in small rooms.
Welcome, everybody, Solo Spotlight. I'm your host, Ryan McDougall. I'm here with Arlo Maverick. How you doing, man?
I'm doing good. Thank you.
Appreciate you for coming out, man. This is awesome, getting to sit down with someone who's kind of been creating art and doing music and all this type of stuff for so long. It's like we were saying before we started, this is a huge like testament to like your perseverance and consistency, and even going through the different forms that you've had of being in a group project to being in, you know, a solo to filming documentaries. I'm so excited to talk about all of that. How you feeling today?
I'm feeling good. Feeling good. Feeling great.
Yeah. That's awesome, man. Yeah, I it's interesting because I think when people hear about you now, they don't kind of know, like, this is the tip of the iceberg. Like, yeah. We're talking about like a glacier that, you're kind of sitting on all this experience, right? And that was really interesting when I was doing my research and stuff. You know, hearing it brought me right back. Brought me right back to like all of these different major like group like artists, like Naughty by Nature, Gangstar. Like for the last week, like that's all I've been listening to is just like old school. I've been listening to some Big Pun, like just really like getting into it. And obviously your guys' work as well. But take me through that. So the year's 2002 or 2000, what one is it?
Well, here's the thing. Politic Live as a group officially comes into formation in 2000 under that moniker. But previously we had another name. And it's something that we had back in high school. And so, Politic Live itself is essentially 2000, and that was essentially myself, my two cousins, Big and Ulti, Dirk Gritty, and DJ Sonny Grimes. And so with that, it was us as a hip-hop group from Edmonton's West End wanting to create something that would represent for the city and also allow us to have fun because we loved hip-hop, we loved performing. Earlier than that, we were part of a group called the Juveniles, which was a super group. We were big fans of like Wu-Tang and Boot Camp Click. So The idea of having a crew of hip hop MCs that would be all across the city. So we had people in the North Side, West End, and the South Side. And so that time period in Edmonton hip hop was one in which we were cutting our teeth, as people like to say, on talent shows, pep rallies at schools. There was a gentleman by the name of Don Joyce who used to host a lot of all ages events. He also worked in television. So through him, we were able to see ourselves perform. Getting those earlier videos allowed us to really identify what areas we need to work on. And in addition to that, there was also people like Captain Abdul who had talent shows that were like all ages shows. And so we were essentially put into a situation where we, it's not like it is now where we have our own music. We were essentially rapping over instrumentals of whoever had like the dopest beats at that time.
Right.
So we'd write our songs to their beats, come up with the verses and basically trade them back and forth. And they'd be a range of topics, right? One of the first shows that we did, and this is, I had a conversation with someone yesterday. And I said that my growth and evolution as an artist is something that is reflective of Edmonton's growth and evolution, something that's reflective of hip hop's growth and evolution, something that's reflective of Canadian hip hop's growth and evolution. And the reason why I say that is because I can look back at certain time periods within my life and see that, okay, Edmonton's here and Arlo Maverick's here. And then move forward, Edmonton is here, Arlo Maverick is here. And when you go back through that that timeline, you start seeing the evolution. You start seeing that there's more hip hop artists that are coming out. You start seeing that there's more outlets for hip hop.
Yeah.
CJSR, a radio station I was at for a number of years prior to me being there, they were an outlet for people to hear hip hop at a time period where hip hop wasn't as accessible as it is now. And so when I started doing radio in 2000, 98. Yeah, goddamn, it's right. So when I started doing it at that point in time, local artists weren't necessarily getting airplay. You might have a DJ who might like consider the fact of playing your song if they knew you. But when I got in there, I'm an artist and I'm just like, why are we not giving more voices to or outlets and opportunities for people to hear the voices of Edmonton hip hop artists? And so with the show that I had, Urban Hang Suite originally, the Nocturnal Lions Den with DJ Sunny Grimes, we start incorporating local artists into the mix. And so I'm not just looking at it from the standpoint of I'm part of this group, Politic Live, we need to be heard. I'm looking at it from the standpoint of Dark Sun Tribe needs to be heard. CV's Finest needs to be heard. Pete Game needs to be heard. Tough House needs to be heard. Like, just
creating a culture.
Creating a culture, 100%. Smash Benz. It was like so much artists that we were interacting with. And the way that I've seen it is that, at least in my opinion, we should be taking cues from more successful hip hop scenes. So if we see that there is Stretch and Bobbito who have a hip hop show that's allowing for MCs to come in and do freestyles, we should be doing that here. We need an Edmonton equivalent. And shouts out to guys like Poetic Akin, who had Underground Sound, which was doing something very similar and kind of creating that blueprint. And even before that, like, the thing with it is that I never want to be that guy who comes in and says, I did it first and it was never there before, because there's always people who are doing things that sometimes you may not be aware of. Like, so prior to me, like, even being of age to like, be on a radio show, there was guys that came before me. So Minister Faust, who had the Terror Dome, right? There was T-E-D-D-Y, who had the Black Experience in Sound. You had Don Joyce, who had something on another radio station. And Clickety Click, A-OK, like Little Billy, Big Billy, One Nation. Like, it's, again, it's fascinating because I'm listening to these guys. And I'm getting DJ Roach, which is so crazy because, sorry, I'm going to be all over the map.
No, keep going.
When I was only in like grade seven or so, there was a DJ by the name of DJ Roach who had a show called The Roach Motel. It was from midnight till 3 o'clock on Saturdays. And from time to time, he would do from midnight till six. And he had this thing, I can't remember the name of it. It might've been called like 15 Minutes of Fame or something like that. So he would actually open up the phone lines and let people call in and rap on air. But if you curse, he dumped you. And dumping is basically you get cut off.
Yeah.
You know? And so one night I call in, right? And like, this is like past midnight on the weekend.
And grade seven.
Grade seven, right? And I should be in bed right now, okay? Mm-hmm. And I'm on the phone. And luckily, this is back in the days where house phones didn't, or at least in my house, we didn't have the phone where it's just like, if you pick up the phone, then it lights it up on another phone to let someone know that, hey, someone's on the phone, don't answer the phone, right? So I'm on the phone in my room trying to get out this rap, but trying not to wake up my mom and everyone else in the house. And I'm like, where have I been? And I'm doing it. And I'm just like, and he dumped me. And I was like so upset because I'm just like, he doesn't know that on the other end is this aspiring hip hop artist who should be in bed because he's like, however old I was in grade seven, but I want to rap and I want him to hear me because I'm like, hey, one day I'm going to be on your show, you know?
How early on was your exposure to like music? Like did you always been like exposed to music and like kind of learning that? Or was it like a time where you really got into different like parts of rap or R&B and stuff like that?
Well, here's the thing. And I've said this in previous interviews, but my cousin Donovan is probably the most integral person as it relates to me becoming like a fan of hip hop, right? He's in Edmonton back in like the 80s, there were these cassette tapes that used to get floated around, right? And people would dub them on cassette tapes and basically share them, so on and so forth. And so one day he comes home and he's playing a tape that had UTFO, which was a big act like in the 80s, right?
Right.
And so he's playing this. He's playing this around the house, which is crazy because like my cousin has never been a hip hop guy, but for some reason he brings home this cassette tape, and my two other cousins, Big Analti and Dirk Gritty, we hear this and we just fall in love with this thing. So we're breakdancing, we're rapping along to the lyrics, so on and so forth. And that basically starts our love for this whole thing. Right. Mm-hmm. And as we get older, we're doing freestyles, but never writing anything down because we didn't know how to write.
Right.
And so one day in church, we were out at Rocky Mountain House in Alberta, and I was there for a church convention. And this one woman by the name of, she was a girl at the time, Debbie Carpenter, who's a little bit older than me. She is in the back of church, not during the sermon. I want to make that very clear because I've told the story before and I've never included that it wasn't during the sermon. I want people to be aware of that. We had time to kill.
Yeah.
And she's there writing this rap in the back of church. And it was the first time I'd ever saw anybody write a rap. And I was blown away because like she's crossing things out. She's bouncing ideas off of her brother who was there in the mix. And this one guy, Daniel, who was there in the mix. And I'm just like, just amazed. It's like this kid who's like way younger than them. But I looked up to them because they were the cool kids from our church who just like, they listened to the coolest music. They were just like, just so smart and just like, just you're seeing giants, even though they're like.
And it kind of all clicks. You go like, oh shit, that makes total sense. Like 100%. When I heard someone had like a rhyme book where like they just had different sets of rhymes of structures where you're like, never would have thought that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So she's there writing the rhyme. And when I see that, I'm just like, I think I could do this. Mm-hmm. So I went home that day and wrote a rhyme. Her rhyme is called Straighter from the Ice Age. And I wrote a rhyme called Straighter from the Ice Age because I was just like, it was my blueprint on how to do this thing that I had been playing with for how many years with my cousins, but never understood how to actually do it, you know? And over the course of time, there's a lot that happens, but within that, I just become so immersed in this. And there were two things I was big into when I was a child, drawing and writing rhymes. So I always had my notebook that would have like my scribbles of like just anything that I would draw. And sometimes doing like t-shirts for kids in my neighborhood. Mm-hmm. But I'd also in that same book would also have my rhymes that I would write as well too, you know? Mm-hmm. So
That's interesting because it all kind of like, it leads towards the same, like the same energy of like creating something, right? And like creating something using this type of influence that you have of like your own like lived in perspective, right?
Yeah.
And so now you're getting this group together and you call it Politic Live. It was a group beforehand. Now, talk to me about like the nuances of doing something like this with family members and because I see on one end, it's really good because like you guys are already have that like vested respect for each other and everything like that. But like there's always that thing of like don't mix like family and business and like that's the worst thing you can do. But like talk me through that. How was that experience, especially when you guys started to like emerge as a group and opening for big acts and stuff like that? How did that family dynamic work?
The family dynamic worked for us in a very positive way, in the sense that we knew each other when it came to performing on stage. There was a chemistry. When it came to writing with each other, there was a chemistry. We understood each other in a way that I think most people who just form a group aren't able to do, right? We had known each other since the time that we're literally babies, you know? So it's like we're at family gatherings, we're performing like as kids. When we would go to Jamaica, we would actually... In Jamaica, it's not called a porch, it's called a veranda. And so on the veranda, we would actually do dance routines, sometimes to like Michael Jackson songs, whatever the case may be. And then the community would come out to watch us. So for us, we were always a trio that performed together. Mm-hmm. So now when you put that in the sense of coming with song concepts or performing on stage, then it allows for us to be able to be locked in a way that I don't think most of the acts take much longer to get to that
point. Yeah, you're almost like putting a jetpack on all of you guys and like getting up to like level 5 right away. Because it's like working out vibes and figuring out like stepping on people's toes and shit. Yeah. Like, I'm sure that's a big thing when you talk about like, you know, you probably even face that now when you look at collaborating, like how much is too much? When do I got to lay off? Like, and you know. But I think ultimately, like that stuff, you can easily like skip the line on that shit if you have like a good like constitution and good like maturity around it all, right? And the same objective. Like,
yes.
I think that's another thing too, that, you know, you got to have the same objective. Now, I always find this interesting because like every time where you start to get exposure and you start to get this experience, was there ever like a welcome to the league moment?
What do you
like,
mean by that?
Where like you go and you see like you open for an act and you're like, oh, there's levels to this shit. Yeah. You're like, oh, like I'm doing it and I'm in my own lane and whatever. And then you go see something and you're like, oh, all right. Well, like, okay. Yeah. Well, okay. Big dog. Like,
You know what? Wow. There was so many moments like that. Sometimes those moments would happen when we would be where we would be in situations where it would be a local artist who would make us realize that, okay, you need to step your game up, you know?
Like someone's just like really like grinding it out and you're like, and you're like, oh, I thought I was putting in work, but nowhere near close to this time.
Yeah. And it's funny because it happened a few different times. Two earlier instances of it happening was there was a band called the Hyphonics that were much older than us, much more polished, rehearsed like crazy, and they had a live band, and we're like, how do we compete with this? You know, and it's like you're and a lot of these situations happened at talent shows where it's just like everyone is in their own silos, like practicing because the day's coming up, and you're like, okay, yo, we've got it, we're gonna win this, and then it's just like, no, you're not.
Was there a type of like producer or like you know, instrumentalist that was in this area that kind of helped you guys find like the sound that you guys stuck with, like in terms of, did that take time to find out like, oh, this is the type of music we're trying to make? Because you can tell like it's very like it's very upbeat. You guys are doing like quick switches, but it's very like acoustically, like it's you know, it's high up, right? Like it's high energy, right? Where sometimes like you look at like, you know, say you look at like a Wu-Tang where it's like, it's very like harsh, right? Yeah. Like it's very like harsh where like people are like getting in, right?
Yeah.
Where sometimes it's more like uplifting. Was there like a measurement there of like trying to find that sound that matches your guys' like style of rap?
Yes. So the first producer that we ever worked with, this is prior to us becoming Politic Live, was a gentleman by the name of Kato Pinnock, next to Vandal. And so he was essentially like what I am to many artists today. He was that for us in the sense of being that mentor who it wasn't just about producing for us. It was about teaching us the business side of things and also how to be great performers.
Mm-hmm.
And the production style that he introduced us to, because that's where we got our first beats ever made, right?
Mm-hmm.
Taught us so much. And I think that essentially gave us the foundation for what we were looking for within our sound.
Mm-hmm.
And then fast forward to a little bit later on, Kata is less active with music. And there was a gentleman by the name of Stress who had a studio called Smash Benz. He was part of a group called Smash Benz as well, too. And so he becomes the guy who's producing for pretty much almost everybody in the city because he had bought production equipment and production software that was fairly competitive at that time. And it was a big shift from some of the earlier production that you saw with some of the guys from like the 90s or whatever in Edmonton hip hop. And so the early 2000s, he is the guy that pretty much just dominates with his sound. And like, with that, we're seeing the way that we can kind of walk that line with mainstream hip hop, because he leaned more towards like mainstream stuff, but we came from a very underground background, you know? And so we're finding that, okay, there's a way we can blur this in order to have that sound. And we're also working with people like Alibi and DJ Nato and Taro Hashimoto and all of that. We're beginning to like tune our ears to like, okay, what is going to be the Politic Live sound?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the producer that kind of helped us create that in a sense, and he ended up working on a majority of our sophomore album Adaptation, which was possibly our most successful album, is Freddie B. Fred Brenton and Brad Smith, who that production experience changed how we approach making music.
Mm-hmm.
That was us actually sitting down with the producer, creating the stuff from scratch. It wasn't a situation of buying beats, which is very typical in hip hop where someone will send you like a beat pack and so on and so forth. And not to say that we didn't sit down with people like Stress or Next to Vandal, but with Brad and Fred, it was slightly different in the sense that we took the experience of what we learned from these previous production sessions, and now we were able to contribute in a more meaningful way. And so that begins the whole idea of working with producers in a different context, which then allows us to create and define our own sound. And then by the time we come around to Ellipsis, which was the last Politic Live album, it was all of that plus looking at how Dr. Dre and Kanye West and Chaos from Canada, those three producers, I would say, kind of allowed us to, and still till this day, I use that same production approach where you put the best minds in the room, producers, musicians, other artists, and you create collectively and allow for the room to basically dictate whether or not the music is good, you know? As opposed to like someone just creating music and then you're off in your silo and you're writing to it. Now it's a matter of, okay, we've got five producers in the room and we've got a bunch of musicians where it's just like, okay, we need a bass line. Okay, cool. All right. I need something on the drums, but I need it. Okay, get the drummer on. So then now they're creating. And now it's just like all of that's coming together. And eventually it lives as something that people can listen to. Mm-hmm. And become inspired by or find their story within that.
Do you think in the U.S., like the big East Coast, West Coast thing, it's a big thing. Do you think in Canada, like the type of music you guys were creating at the time was like totally like on the other side of the coin as say like music made in Ontario and like that far east?
Yeah, I do think, well, here's the thing. I think that the producers, and this is, I gotta give a shout out to people like Dangerous Goods, Stray and Touch, Next to Vandal, Deadless. The producers of that era created a sound, even 118, shouts out to Little Billy. The producers at that time period were creating a sound that was very Edmonton in the sense that it was like, we come from a blue collar, mm-hmm. working class city. So very grimy, very dirty, very gritty. But at the same time though, like when I look at the population and the makeup of it, like the Politic Live sound in itself leaned into our Jamaican roots, right? Mm-hmm. Something that was very typical of Toronto at that time as well, right. too, where they utilized a lot of the Caribbean influence within their music. So I think that across Canada, there has been a sound that kind of has a through line all mm-hmm. the way through. But at the same time, though, there are things that are very specific as you begin to go deeper into those catalogs that allow you to realize that this is definitely an Edmonton sound. This right. is definitely a Toronto sound or a Scotian sound. The biggest thing with Canada, I think, which was a huge knock to us for the longest time, is that people saw most of our producers as being very East Coast influenced, right? Mm-hmm. So boom bap, like as yeah. Canadians, we love lyrics, you know? And not to say Americans don't love lyrics, but like for us, we reminisce on a time in hip hop where it was lyrics, freestyles, B-boys, B-girls, mm-hmm. graph artists, DJs, and you see it in our city, you know? And so that comes through in the music in the sense of celebrating those elements. But I do think that there's a way to still preserve that while still evolving the culture, because the culture has to evolve, but it can't evolve to the point where it doesn't look like hip hop, you know?
And it's really interesting because like a lot of people that have paved the way for like Canadian music, like you look at Ghetto Child, you look at Classified. There's a Ghetto Child in Nova Scotia. Yeah.
Holy shit.
But you look at like Classified, you look at like Chaos, you look at like Cardinal Official. Like he was one of the guys that popped. Like he was able to kind of get out to mainstream. Mercules.
Yeah.
Guys like that where they kind of bridge the gap, but it's like there's a lot of, it's like you're just looking at the tip of the iceberg of like 100%. All of these other artists that really like are putting people on. Mad Child,
you know? And what's interesting is that I remember talking with Moto, who's a hip-hop MC in the city here. Him and his brothers had a group called TOA, and this is like probably around like I want to say early 2010s, and we had brought them out for a show they had in Calgary. And on the way back, we're listening to some music, and I was playing it for some Cadence Weapon. He's like, who is this? And at that point in time, like, he's still young. He's not really, you know? And so I was explaining to him, and for me, it's a situation where it's just like, I always love to, like, educate people on things because I'm just, like, very much of a historian. So I'm sharing with him Cadence Weapon's relevance to music at that time because he's from Edmonton, but a lot of the stuff he was doing in the early 2000s, mid-2000s, I should say, ends up impacting so many other artists from the U.S. who go on to become like these well-respected progressive hip-hop artists, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's one of those things where, to speak to what you're saying about the sound of Edmonton, like, I think that's one of the things that has made us unique in the sense that we are influenced by so much of what's going on in America and the world as it relates to hip hop, but at the same time that we're also contributing something that is uniquely Edmonton. Yeah. You know?
So you guys have like, you know, you guys go on a big run, like probably 14 years. And then things slow down as they are, like people age, like having families, et cetera, et cetera. What was the kind of necessity for you to kind of like start your own lane? And this is kind of where Lil Maverick like started up, right? Because I find that interesting because like did you have any like apprehensions of like, yo, like I was able to lean on two other guys and this guy and like, you know, can I brunt the weight of like the branding and this and that, and now I'm going to be at the forefront? Like was it kind of conversations that you had with yourself of like, am I as good as I say I am?
Yeah, no, those conversations were had. What's funny is that when we were working on Notoriety, which was the first Project Lab album. And we took so much time with that. That's one thing that anybody who knows me knows, that I'm not one to just rush an album out, right? Mm-hmm. From the songs to the beat selection to just the performance on the record, so on and so forth, I'm very much of a creative in that aspect, right? Mm-hmm. And so when we had wrapped up, when we were actually getting ready to wrap up Notoriety, a friend of mine, Corey Hoff, said, friend of the group, I should say, said, because we were working on the solo projects for Big and Ulti and Dirk Gritty to come after, because we had this whole plan of like, okay, we're going to drop this album, then we're going to have the solo projects come, and then we're going to come back and do another album, so on and so forth, kind of like Wu-Tang, right? Mm-hmm. And there was never an intention for me to do a solo project, right?
Right.
And so he had said, hey, so when are you dropping your solo project? I'm like, yeah, it'll be called Maybe Tomorrow, and it's coming in 2008, right?
Right.
It never came up. Or it didn't come out in 2008. It just did come out eventually, right? But when it came time for us to, for Baltic Lab to kind of like, I don't want to say close the chapter, because I think the chapter's all, the book is always open, right? Gritty, we were working on Ellipsis, and Ellipsis is like almost 3 years in the making.
Right.
And I'm like, okay, cool. I need you to re-record the verse. He's like, Arlo, I'm not recording another verse. Put the album out.
Right.
And then I'm like, but bro, he's like, no, like, we need to get this album out, right? Because he's in a transition time period where he's about to get married, he's having a second child, and for him it's a matter of, like, he's looking at it from the standpoint of, my priorities have changed.
Yeah, like, I don't got time for them.
Yeah, and so, bro, me, I, no child, no, yeah. You know, so I'm just like, okay, he's like, no, you need to get the album out. And like, so we get the album out, and then he's like, you need to do a solo project. I'm just like, bro, no, we're going to work on the next project. He's like, no, you need to. So just where he was at in life kind of pushed me to like dive into this project that I had in the back of my head for the longest time. But I always looked at it from the standpoint of, I'm not the strongest member of the group, so I should not be the one releasing a solo project. Mm. You know, Bigga has the ability to craft these catchy, memorable, fun songs. And also go into more depth lyrically as well, too. Gritty has the ability to write these songs that are very thought-provoking and very, very much a human experience, you know? Mm-hmm. I always felt that when it came to my music, me specifically, like, I would overthink things. I'm just like, that doesn't make great for a solo artist. It makes great for a person who's contributing to a collective, but as far as me being a solo artist, that's not the wave, you know?
What did it make you feel like when RJ Crew made you redo your verse on Behind the Sound? Does that fuck you up?
No. You know what? I'm very used to that process.
Right.
Because for me, I don't go into anything with any ego. And it's probably one of the reasons why people enjoy working with me, because I always say that if you give me the directions, I will get us there.
Right.
And sometimes I think as producers, and this is something that I'm trying to encourage more producers in our city to realize, that a lot of the artists you're working with have the talents, have the capabilities, but no one's ever given them that guidance for them to be able to deliver on their talents in the way that they can.
It's almost like, this ain't about you.
100%.
You know what I mean?
Like, it's about the artist.
Yeah.
It's about, how do you get this artist to tap into that thing that allows them to give the best performance? And the thing that we don't realize in the city, in a lot of cities, not just Edmonton, but the thing we don't realize is that our favorite artists have people who are producing them vocally in the studio. It's not just the music that's being produced. And the producers, like, this is why, like, Dr. Dre is one of my favorite producers, is that we hear the horror stories of Dr. Dre making Eve or Eazy-E or Snoop repeat the same word over and over again till they say it in a way that he says, that sounds good. And those artists are just frustrated. They're just like, what is wrong with this guy? And then the song comes out and it's a hit, and they're just like, you do know what you're doing.
Yeah.
You know? So I think that producers in this city, if we want to see better artistry come out, you have to know your stuff first and foremost, but you have to be willing to listen to the artist and be like, okay, let's try this. Mm-hmm. And as the artist begins to hear, like, yo, the song sounds better because I sang it this way, or I, like, when we did my latest project, my most recent project, blue collar, Ari was like, him and I would sit down there and he would basically sometimes make me rewrite my verse because he's like, it's good. And same thing with Kaz, same thing with Uzi. These guys would sometimes make me rewrite a verse, rewrite a line because they're just like, that's not good enough. Mm-hmm. And I had to, I don't want to say eat that or swallow that because it's not a hard thing for me to do. It's a situation
of... It just takes a type of maturity, though.
100%. And it also takes...
To just go, maybe there's something I'm not seeing.
Seeing, 100%. And majority of the time, you're not seeing something. Sometimes they're not seeing something, but majority of the time, because you become so attached to these lyrics or this flow or whatever the case may be, you're just like, no, I think it's good. But when RJ told me that, I'm just like, I've known RJ for... like a long time.
Mm-hmm.
He's worked with me, he's worked with multiple artists. If he's telling me I think you do a better take, then I know I can do a better take.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I got to trust that he's looking out for my best interest, and I think that that's the trust that needs to be there with producer and artist. But a lot of times the producers are not invested in the artist, and so the artist is just like, well, I'm just here to do my thing, as opposed to being a thing where it's just like the producer is invested in the artist and the artist is like, I can trust you because I know that this is not just a paycheck to you.
Right. Do you think that's a hard struggle though when you talk about people creating something out of thin air? And then it's like, when you look at something like creating lyrics or creating beats, like everything's so close to people's chest that it's like, to even get like criticism, you know what I mean? Like, do you think that's a struggle that a lot of artists face of like, it just hurts?
Yeah, no, like... In your head, you have the perfect rhyme.
Yeah, you're like, I'm hitting. Yeah. Like, this is it. And then someone comes in and they go, yeah, like, this part you can fix. And you're like...
Who are you?
Yeah, you're like, what the fuck, man? Like, and it's interesting because I think that, like, when... Especially, like, when we get into talking about your filmmaking and stuff, like, you're constantly, like, at these, like, moments where it's like, do I take advice from this guy?
Yeah.
Or do I, like... be a dick, right?
Yeah.
And it's, I think it's a very hard thing to do because you're talking about so much that there's so much passion and so much and so much vulnerability where it's 100%. Like, even the fact that I even brought this to you was like me sticking my neck out and then you're telling me I need to fix it?
Yeah.
Like, what the fuck, man? Yeah. Right? But getting in, like, do you think that was like a level up for you to like do your own music, but also like make it more personal. And now you're almost like diving into like your next evolution as an artist. What was that experience like for you when you started like making different lyrics and telling these stories and getting into this like storytelling? But not only that, storytelling where like you are the main character, where it's like things aren't distributed across like, you know, so if you're on like a group thing and you don't have the best verse, it's like, it's still a hit song. Yeah. Like, we're good. It's like, you're kind of leaning on yourself pretty hard.
Yeah, no. And I think the great part about that whole process was that I had to be vulnerable in a sense that, okay, people didn't want another Politic Lab album from Arlo. Mm-hmm. They wanted an Arlo Maverick album. And now it's a matter of, okay, well, what can you do? Mm-hmm. What can you do on your own? And can you keep an audience's attention from beginning to end? And so there was with Maybe Tomorrow, which was the first solo project, like that took roughly 3 years to create, where, again, going through that whole process of writing songs and feeling they weren't good enough and then going back to the drawing board. There's multiple versions of the album that people have never heard because we're just like, okay, this is not good enough. So then we... go back and it's like hearing these things and it's just like, okay, then you start to question like, should I really be doing this? So on and so forth. And eventually you allow for that art to just be put out there. And once it's put out there, the feedback, whether it's positive or negative, is something that you have to, as my grandmother would say, rest in peace, pick sense out of nonsense. And so, and it's a Jamaican saying, by the way, it's not just her, but, picking sense out of nonsense is essentially getting all of this and saying, okay, what is applicable to this situation, right? And so there's a lot of things that working with Cameron Brown on my first project where he was trying to teach me things that I just was not not mature enough as a person, but not mature enough as an artist to understand. Mm-hmm. And then as I'm doing Soul Merchant and doing the songs in between, maybe tomorrow on Soul Merchant, all of a sudden these things are clicking, right? And those are the moments that are the greatest, because it's just like, okay, cool. Like, I've figured this thing out. And then you want to bring it to that person and be like, hey, I know what you were talking about.
Yeah.
I get it. You know, and it's just like, okay, now that that has been discovered, now that has been learned, then it's just like, okay, how do we apply this to the rest of it? You know, and it's like you're evolving and like getting new information and figuring out, okay, how do we build upon this? One of the things with Ari for Blue Collar was me being more in the pocket. A lot of times I rhyme on top of the beat, which is something that is just, no other producer was ever vocal enough to be like, hey, let's sit down
and ride with it,
you know?
Yeah.
Most of them were just like, okay, he's done recording, okay, next song. And to me, that's a huge disservice, because that represents not just that artist, that represents you as a producer. And I think that when we start taking pride in what we do and also developing our skill sets to now, when we work with each other, work with people, we're coming from a place of, I want you to shine the brightest, and mm-hmm. I want to be able to attach my name to you when you shine, mm-hmm. as opposed to, this was a paycheck, I did what I did, and I acted as an engineer in the studio instead of acting as a producer who's going to help you even just get into the right mind space. Because if I'm doing a song that's about, I'll show you something. There's a song on Politic Lab's album called Adaptation called Enough, featuring Keisha Turner. And it's a love song, but it's like this relationship that's come to an end, so on and so forth. And every time I listen back to the verse, I'm just like, how come no one told me that I shouldn't have rap with that tone?
Mm.
Because the tone comes off as more as like a battle rap than a guy who's talking about a relationship.
Reflecting.
Yeah. And I'm just like, and it's one of those things where with the producers that I'm working with now, somebody would have been like, why are you approaching it from this standpoint? Let's try this.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that goes back to what I said earlier on in the conversation, where my evolution mirrors the city's evolution.
Mm-hmm.
Because 20 years ago, producers wouldn't feel comfortable saying, hey, I don't think that's the right tone to take.
Mm-hmm.
Now they do, right? Mm-hmm. So it's one of those things where we're all growing collectively, and we have to give each other grace to know that, okay, well, hey, like, I wasn't at that stage yet. Maybe my ears weren't tuned to hear that, mm-hmm. or maybe I wasn't comfortable enough to actually say that to you, although I know that it needed to be said.
Mm-hmm.
But now that we're at this place here, let's continue to grow, and let's share what we know. If with every project that an artist works on, whether it's the artist, the producer, the musician, you're learning new things.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the things you have to bring back to the city, bring back to the community, and be like, hey guys, like, I learned this thing when I was at this writing retreat in such and such. I attended a songwriting camp, I was at a producer camp, whatever the case may be, and this is what I learned. Like, can we try this? When you try that, all of a sudden the scene and the community and your project grows, mm-hmm. right?
You think that's rare though? Because people go like, yo, I ain't trying to have you clip my shit.
Yeah.
You know, like, and it's yeah. really screwed up. Like, I echo the same sentiment where it's like, if I go do something, I'm like, guys, like, check this out.
No. Yeah,
like, let's like crack it open. Like, look at what I learned. Look, I bought this new thing, and like, this is what it taught me, blah, blah, blah. And like, but do you think kind of it's, you got to find the right people for that? Cause it's like, it might not be a reciprocal thing where it's like, I might be dropping gems on everybody. And then it's like, when push comes to shove and it's time to like, you know, hey man, can you come like help me with this? Nah, I'm good.
Yeah.
And you're like, yeah. But again, it all kind of ties back into like having that maturity to know,
yes.
like, yo, we don't all have the same goal.
Yeah.
Like, this guy might generally just be listening to me to steal my shit and move on. And like, I, at some point have to be okay with that and understand that like, well, it's really on me for like allowing that space.
Yeah.
I just got to do a better job at like vetting the people that I'm like telling. Right.
Yeah.
But the type of introspectiveness and like the type of willingness you are to like create this culture, I think that that's like a very rare trait that not a lot of people have. I don't think that rarity comes from the fact that people don't have people's good in mind.
Yeah.
I think it comes from like fear. And I think it comes from like people, like they just have a really hard time, like even knowing like, am I doing the right shit?
Yeah.
And like now I'm a little insecure and like, like, imagine if you go like preach gospel to 10, 20 people and then they all start dropping like flies, like start failing.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, fuck, like this ain't a good look, right? And I think it comes from that fear. And like, what is some ways that you were able to kind of like overcome that like fear or like able to like gain balance in yourself? Because I think that's like a big thing that I'm reading into this of like, you were able to like have these conversations with yourself and whether or not like someone agrees with it or this and that, you were able to kind of like make your art and get in the rooms with the right people and like be okay with that. Where a lot of people, like they have a hard time like getting there.
Yeah.
So like what was that steps like, especially when you talk about going from like a group like perspective into like a solo artist where like now you have all this experience behind you and you're kind of like doing it all over again. Like you have the experience, but now it's kind of like, all right, like clean the whiteboard off. Like now I'm back to the right
square one.
Talk me through that. Like how did you gain that introspectiveness and like just kind of like building that self-esteem up?
I mentioned my grandmother so much in this interview. She's a big reason for that. I think that there was, growing up, her and I spent so much time together, going to church, so on and so forth. And she was someone who was very reflective, someone who was constantly looking at where she had been and where she was and sharing those gems. Mm-hmm. And I think that I just began applying that to, whether it was intentionally or unintentionally, I began applying that. And I think that with that introspection, I'll say this. People are more willing to follow someone who has done the work and has a track record of success, right? I'm not a platinum selling artist. I am an artist who has created music that has allowed me to chart. As I began to chart, I show people within my community like, hey, this is what I'm doing to achieve this. They follow that blueprint.
Mm-hmm.
Critical acclaim. I get it. I show my community, this is how you do this, right? And so I think that every step along the way, I've learned something and brought it back. And if there's been skepticism, then there's skepticism. But when you see me do it repeated times, it's just like, okay, this guy's onto something, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that we have to lead by example. I think that there is, and it's not to say we're not going to have failures. It's not going to say we're not going to make mistakes or anything like that. But it's a matter of, as hokey as it sounds, it's a matter of the lesson that you're getting from that loss, right? It's a matter of how you turn things around and prove your resilience, because some people will get knocked down and they're just like, okay, like I can't do this. But then there's some people who push forward. And that's one of the things that people always say to me. They're just like, bro, like I've known you from elementary school when you were like doing raps and you're still doing this. I'm like, cause I love this. Right. Mm-hmm. And so it's a matter of taking those things and modeling them in a way that allows people to realize that the reflection is needed because, sorry, I feel like I'm kind of on the list right now, but one of the things I will say is that every year since I was like 15, I do a retrospect for the year, right?
Mm-hmm.
From Paul the Glad days, I can tell you what we did in 1995, right?
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you what I did last year. And part of this is me putting into perspective the journey I've come along. Some of it is because you need to promote the things you've done. And that promotion leverages opportunities, festivals, grants, tours, collaborations, people wanting to work with you, radio play, so on and so forth. But part of it is also the reminder that you've come too far to stop.
Mm.
And I think a lot of times because we don't document as artists, like I'll write grants for artists and be like, okay, first and foremost, we have to get a bio for you. What have you done? And they're like, then they start trying to remember all these things in their heads. I'm just like, you haven't documented this? They're just like, I didn't know I was supposed to. So then we go through a whole process of digging, and some artists have saved articles. They have a digital footprint, but some artists don't, right?
Mm.
And once we get them like all caught up, I'll say to them, document everything. And I'll give them the type of stuff they should be looking for, because the documentation is good for two reasons. One, it allows them to have that thing they can always go back to and be like, okay, I've come this far. Why am I quitting?
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that once they start seeing all these things they're achieving, now it's just like, okay, I want to achieve more. I want to do this. I want to do that. Right. And so if we have something that allows us to know where we've been and allows us to know where, and then have a roadmap to where we're going, it helps us to keep pushing. And then what we don't realize is that if all of us are doing this, then it creates the ecosystem that helps us sustain a music society in Edmonton, mm-hmm. or in Alberta or in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
But if one person is winning and they're not allowing others to understand that blueprint for their winning, then that person eventually gets to a point where there's nothing there to support them.
Mm-hmm.
If I look at it just from a hip hop perspective, right? And I've mentioned this to other people on so many occasions. In Canada, we could have I'll look at Calgary, because the Edmonton Music Awards is currently not happening, right?
Right.
YYC Music Awards has a country category. You go up one level. We have the Alberta Country Music Awards. So you have awards for producers, singers, musicians, all of this, music mm-hmm. videos, right? Then you go up and we have the Canadian Country Music Awards, right? Mm. Then you have the Western Canadian Music Awards. Then you have the Juno Awards. And at each one of those levels, country is being celebrated and the people who create and facilitate the careers of country music artists are being celebrated.
Mm.
And no one's saying, well, there could only be one. There's so much to the point that they have a Canadian Country Music Award. They have an Alberta Country Music Award. They have a category in the Western Canadian Music Awards. They have a category at the YYC Music Awards. They have a category at the Juno Awards.
Right? Is that because their artists are like reinvesting in like the culture?
That's like, part of it.
You know, like everybody's trying to pool all of their music together to have a selection process and stuff like that, where, like you've alluded to, like sometimes artists aren't cataloging that. So it's like, where do we grade?
100%. And when you look at it, and there's also like structural things that are systemic things that are there. But I think the first step is us looking at, okay, what can we be doing differently? Right. Mm-hmm. Because when we're able to address the things that we could be doing differently, then now it's just like, okay, we standardize this whole music industry.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're looking at hip hop in particular, right? I'm a hip hop artist, so let's look at hip hop, right? Standardize it to the point that every hip hop artist in the city has a bio, a CV, has all these things that are just like fundamental things that they should have. Right? Mm-hmm. That they understand how to apply for a grant. They understand how to book a tour. They understand how to apply for a festival, understand what festivals to be applying for.
Mm-hmm.
And they're able to understand how to work with a manager, how to work with a publicist, how to work with a booking agent, have an understanding of like, okay, if I am trying to promote my music, who are the podcasts that I'm showing up to, right? Mm-hmm. Who are the podcasts that I'm reaching out to and saying, hey, and obviously doing it through the proper channels, to a publicist, so on and so forth. Or even just doing it independently as well, too, because that's something I did for a number of years. But understanding all these different outlets and channels, because once we start doing that, now it makes sense to be like, hey, you know what? Let's have an Alberta Hip Hop Awards.
Mm-hmm.
Because now you have multiple artists, you have producers, engineers, everything, the full gamut. But when we are kind of fragmented and none of us have a standardized goal that we're trying to reach, then it's hard to create a foundation, right?
Right.
Where other genres have the years. And that's one thing that we have to keep in mind as well, too, is that other genres have years of being recognized to radio, the Juno, so on and so forth. So they have that foundation. But that's not to say that we can't create something, because in the 50 years that hip hop has been around, it has achieved a lot.
Mm-hmm.
A lot, you know? Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Do you find like doing work like this and then focusing on like your own trajectory? Like you kind of have to know, okay, I can only put like so much here, because then I'm going to not ruin, but I'm almost going to like put the e-brake on my own work. And like, where is that balance at of like putting your effort into like growing a community and doing this, but also like focusing on new projects and how does that balance look like, especially with someone who's still creating? You know, it's not like you're retired, you know, from the game, right? So it's one of those things where it's probably a fine balance.
It's definitely a fine balance, and sometimes the community work does take precedent over the solo or the Maverick work, right? And that's not to say it's like this devastating thing or anything like that. It's more so me looking at it from the standpoint of the work that I do on the admin or executive side is opening doors for others, but it's also opening doors for myself, right? Mm-hmm. And so
rising tide lifts all ships.
100%. And most people say that, but they don't actually mean that.
Mm-hmm.
For me, currently right now, I'm the chair of the Rap Advisory Committee for the Junos. And so the work that I'm doing with that is so beneficial towards Edmonton and Canada as a whole, but there's never been, to my knowledge, possibly Click was in this position, but there's never been a Edmonton-based, actually, yeah, I'll say that. There's never been an Edmonton-based chair of the Rap Music Advisory Committee for the Junos. So now I'm literally connecting with CARIS, which is the governing body of the Junos. Plus I'm connecting with the Rap Advisory Committee and getting to have conversations with people where they're just like, so what's happening in Edmonton? Mm-hmm. And the sacrifice that I make, and I don't really see it as a sacrifice, I see it as
like a benefit.
Benefit. It's what I do. It's what I love, right? Yeah. So me taking that time to build these relationships with people is allowing for, with like key industry people, is benefiting Edmonton in the sense that now people are aware of what's going on here. And I've opened up portals for mentorship with people from the key market in Canada, which is Toronto, right? Mm-hmm. I've been able to connect people for different opportunities. And these are opportunities that make people say, wow, like Edmonton really has something cool going on there. And in the long run, that benefits me, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's not a situation where I go into it and I'm like, well, how's this going to benefit me right now? It's
and you gain a lot of credibility. Like people can grow to see you as a reputable, like, person to come to for advice and mentorship and stuff like that. And as well, like, you know, you're putting notches in your belt too of being able to say like, this is a whole new experience.
Oh,
of able to like network with people and establish those relationships. And it's very interesting because it allows this whole side of like the education part that we kind of talk about, where it's like, yes, a lot of it is like educating people or even just like having the trust in yourself and having like the willingness to kind of make that space for people, right? What I find interesting too is to break off into a whole nother section is when did you start making music videos for your songs, and did that coincide with your like getting into like documentary films?
Okay, so I've been documenting from the time that I was very young. Never with the intention of doing a documentary. It was just, I just love having a camera around to film things. I would be involved with music videos in the sense of being a producer, possibly just helping out on set. But the pandemic is actually what forced me to pivot. We weren't able to do performances initially. Eventually we began doing like outdoor concerts during the pandemic, but initially I wasn't able to perform, and so studios were all shut down. I was doing more recording at home, but then there was no place to actually share the music. So I ended up getting laid off for like 7 months. And during that time period, myself and Inda by Natalie made an investment into, at first we were renting equipment, and then we began to purchase the equipment. And a gentleman by the name of Michael McDonald, who's a film prof or a music prof over at the U of A, someone who's been a friend for a number of years, like, he took the time to help Inda and I both understand the world of filmmaking and how to create music videos. So we went out and we just were very gung-ho. We're just like, okay, we're going to shoot and we're going to edit these videos. We were introduced to a software called DaVinci Resolve, DaVinci Studio. Amazing program that's free for anybody out there. And he's literally taking time out of his day. And we're coming to him with the files for the music videos, and he's helping us finesse and get the music videos to where they need to be and teaching us along the way in the sense of, okay, cool, this is called depth of field. This is how you achieve depth of field, right? For me, I'm like, a lot of times when I edit, the edits are way too long. He's like, it's a music video. It has to be quick. It's got to be quick. It's got to be quick. So then I'm learning that.
Oh, like the quick switches.
Yes. You know, right. The transitions, sort of, so forth. And like, just small little things where he's like literally taking time out of his day, and not just one day, not just one music video, multiple music videos. And then we end up collaborating on the music video for Hashtag, where I had wrote an idea, and he and I are like sitting in front of his like house, just on his front steps, talking about the idea. And it's like, okay, cool. So he ends up directing that, and I'm co-directing with him, and he's doing like the heavy lifting, right? And so we shoot that music video and edit it on my own, then sit down with him and go through that whole process. And I mentioned that because the next video that we had to do, I had learned so much from working with him, and then also us doing like other things as well too. We were doing virtual performances and creating these little promos, so on and so forth. And then when it came time to shoot the next music video, which was Tap It, we went out and shot the music video. And typically we would sit with Michael and he'd help us with the editing. And for some reason, I think he may have had COVID or something like that. Mm-hmm. So he couldn't actually sit down. So he's like, I can't sit down to help you edit it, but I could do the color correction for it, right? And I think he did. Yeah, I hope I'm not mistaken. I'm almost certain he did the color correction for it. But that was that moment where you start to question, do I really know what I'm doing? Because now
Everything's balls in your court, man.
So then Inda by Natalie, she films it. I do the editing for it. And I'm like, at that point in time, I have Michael McDonald as like my film mentor. And then I have a guy out of Calgary by the name of The Kid T, who's doing these music videos for Moraine. And I'm just like amazed. I'm just like, oh my gosh, these videos are so crazy. And so I'm studying his music videos while keeping the theory of what Michael has taught me. And then we shoot Tap It, which to me was like, at that point in time, I'm just like, okay, I feel like I've shot a music video that I'm proud of, you know? And so Michael does the color correction, it comes out, and the video gets a real positive response. I'm just like, okay, cool. Like, it's one of those things where it's like, when your parent is, you're riding a bike and like, they're holding the seat and you're riding, and then you come to realize that they've let go, and it's just like, I'm actually doing this by myself, you know? So it was a real cool moment, you know?
Yeah,
so,
that's exciting, man. And to talk about that even further, it's nice to even just be in the room with some of the people that are willing to like take their time out, and knowing like, oh, this is Goliath, man. Like, this guy is killing it.
Yeah.
And it's... It almost like inspires you further to like keep going, because you're like, oh man, like if this guy can do it, like I have something to now like chase.
Yes.
Right. Like now I know that like, A, it kind of humbles you because you're like, there's levels to this shit.
100%.
And B, but you're like, well, this is where it can go. Like I can see where, and having those role models is huge. And to tie it back, it's like to put it in retrospect, it's like those indie artists that are seeking advice from you.
Yes.
It's like they see that roadmap and going like, oh shit, this guy's like the, and you got like, it's almost like who watches the watchers?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I always say that of like every mentor has a mentor, right?
Yes.
Cause it's like, it doesn't end.
No, it doesn't.
It never ends, right?
Always learning.
I want to briefly talk about, Blue Collar. You're wearing the sweater. This has been your most recent project that has come out in 2023. Talk me about that, because now at this point, like, you're building like a big collection, and this is kind of like the apex of your storytelling, and like, this is where you're really like flexing it now. And you're talking about like the working class culture of Edmonton, and a lot of the songs are about like, you know, probably spending money or not having a lot of money to spend. And then, you know, talk me through like the inception of like building this concept, and then kind of like the videography on the other side, which like now you're kind of like, you're towing both lines, right? This must have been like a very exciting project for you.
Yes, no, it was a very exciting project. It's interesting because I feel like the blue collar sentiment has been there for quite some time, kind of hovering in the background, but I've like pushed it to the forefront. And with this kind of just speaks towards a situation that happens, I think, with so many people where you go to school for one thing and then you graduate and you can't find a job in your field. Mm-hmm. And so now you are put in a situation where you say to yourself, okay, well, I can work this job that does not necessarily reflect my education, or I can keep holding out while these bills are stacking until I get the job that I want, right? And the great thing with the Blue Collar album is that it does reflect my personal experience, in the sense of going to Nate, graduating from marketing, and then not being able to find something in my field, and then having to work a blue collar job, and then realizing that there is merit to every single job that's out there. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes when we look at it from the standpoint of juxtaposing blue collar to white collar, we're like, especially when you look at Edmonton and Calgary, I've discovered in this last little while, as I do more shows in Calgary and build and try to form a community out there, is that there's a lot of blue collar workers in Calgary, where when we look at it, we just see it as, well, white collar, they got the beautiful buildings,
tech,
so on and so forth. But there's a lot of people who are working night shift. There's a lot of people who are working trades. And the unfortunate thing with hip hop is that we've gotten into this space, and I'm hoping that we're moving back where the space that we've been in has been very much about the self, right? And when you listen to artists like Tupac or Nas or Public Enemy or KRS-One or a lot of the founding MCs, it was about their community. They still spoke about themselves, but so much of what they wrote was about the community they were a part of, right? And so when you listen to Tupac, like Tupac's Brenda's Got a Baby, that's not him rapping about himself. That's him rapping about a totally opposite person, right? And but then he'll balance it out with a song like Dear Mama, right? And so keep your head up about the struggles of women, but then he'll have a song about himself. So it's like, when I look at it, it's just like, as it relates to blue collar, I had to create an album where it's like, let me talk about the community, the city, but let me also share personal stories and how I fit into this whole blue collar perspective, because my family is working class. And hip hop to me should be something that balances that, because so much of it is about, like, it's not to say there wasn't party raps back in the late 70s and early 80s, but we've leaned so much on the party side that we're not talking about what regular everyday people are going through, and they need a soundtrack, not just a soundtrack for their weekends. They need a soundtrack for Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday when they're at their day job, whether it's working in an office or working in a shop, you know, or possibly working on the rigs.
When you're creating an album or a concept, is the notion of like what performs well and what doesn't perform well, is that something that you have to balance? Of like, does every song that I make like something that I'm going to highlight in a performance? Or is there like a couple records that you have in your album where you're like, okay, these guys, these ones are going to be bangers. And like, these ones are the ones, the other ones are like very like studio emotion. Like a lot of these, like there's a lot of intangibles surrounding it,
yeah,
where it's like, can I recreate this feeling
on stage
when I do this on stage?
Yeah.
Is that a balance? And like, how do you measure that?
Well, it's a very tough balance. And I think that one thing I've learned to do as I've grown as an artist is figure out how to make every possible song a song that can be performed. I think now I'm at a point where within the songs, like, for example, a song like NOV, that for most people would be like, that song can't be performed live, but I performed it live before.
Or like Too Many Twos.
Or Too Many Twos, yeah. But Too Many Twos is actually a fan favorite, where
right,
I could perform that anywhere and people will sing along to it, right? Now, a song like Lost My Way, which has a huge gospel chorus in it, I've got two other MCs on there, I've never actually performed that song live, mm-hmm, which is heartbreaking because it's like a lot of people like that song. But like, because I'm very much on very big on collaboration, sometimes there are songs that it becomes very hard to perform live because it's like, I need this person there, I need that person there, or I can do their verses, but it's not the same as them performing it, you mm-hmm know? So I think that as it relates to, if I look through the songs on Blue Collar, the only songs that I have not performed are Late Nights, I Don't Trust You, and Lost My Way. Those are the right three songs I've never performed live.
Right.
And part of the reason, the first two songs is because I'm not as comfortable with singing live as I'd like to be. Because nerves kick in.
Uh-huh.
And when nerves kick in, it's just like, wow, that guy can't
sing.
You're
probably like live testing the audience too of like, ooh,
yeah,
is this... Like, obviously you have your set list, yeah, right? Yeah. But you're probably too like,
Yeah, no.
100%. You know what I mean? Like, okay, people are too hype. Like, and then you drop that on them and then you try to bring them right back up.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, maybe it's... Like, there's a time and place for everything, right?
100%.
But again, like, the fact that you're making music that, because I think that's something that gets taken away from an artist now. Like the idea of like, this shit's supposed to be done live.
Yeah,
like,
that's the whole purpose.
You know what I mean? Like eventually you're supposed to do this shit live, bro. Like you're not supposed to, like, this isn't, you can't curate the environment every single time. So you almost got to like have that ability to be like, oh, it's great in studio, but when it goes, when I perform it's 10 times better. And that's like, I think in today's day and age, that's where you see that total shift of like, things are really good. Like T-Pain had this problem.
Yeah, yeah.
T-Pain had this problem where like he relied so much on the auto tune where then he's going to all these college campuses and they're like,
It's not the same.
But now he's like reinventing himself and he's a great vocalist and like, you know, but I think it's one of those things of people lean into that a lot and they create records for radios and this and that.
Yeah.
And then when it's time to perform it, it's like, there is that balance of like, you have to have the stuff that are like radio friendly and this and that, but you also have to have like the good, you know, it's just amazing too, because like you've sat in so many different eras where it's like, you know, Politic Live, performances were probably a way bigger deal and getting out there and getting that name recognition where it's like you couldn't rely on the platforms that you have now, but now you kind of see that, and with the experience that you have, you're kind of able to leverage that and pull those strings without like abusing it.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Without being like, oh well, I'm just gonna rely on TikTok, right?
Yeah.
So it's very interesting and it's very refreshing, because then when you are able to teach, you know, up and coming artists.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. One thing I really want to get more into is doing performance coaching, because I take pride in building a set that is so memorable.
Mm-hmm.
And I have fun on stage as well too. Like I love performing on stage. We recently just did a show with The Blue, who's a hip-hop artist from Calgary, amazing artist, amazing person. He was doing the tour for his latest album, A Look on the Bright Side. And so the night was a legendary night, in my opinion. We had The Blue as a headliner. I was on before him. Before me was K-Riz, T-Fanny, and K The Chosen. So mm-hmm. we have all these heavy hitters from Alberta's hip-hop community. Mm-hmm. And my friends who came out to the show who weren't familiar with some of the acts on the board, on the bill, they were just like, that was such an amazing night because every performer knew how to perform and how to engage the crowd. And looking back at the footage of the performance that I had, I'm just like, I live for nights like these mm-hmm. where the audience is hyped, they're engaged. Like, we have songs like Day Ones that all of a sudden people are just like sing along with it. And it's just like, when I'm able to see songs that started out as just like an idea that I had at work, and then we worked through it in the studio, and now you're performing it to an audience, and now the audience is singing the words back to you, and they're getting hype, and so on and so forth. Like, to me, those are great moments. And like, as you said, what we're creating in the studio has to live on stage at some point in time. So for me, it's a matter of like studying great performers and saying, how do I incorporate something into my set that's like that, but is Arlo Maverick, mm-hmm. you know?
And when you even going back on our conversation, when you talked about the producer that said like you were rapping on top of the beats instead of like being in the pocket,
yeah.
it's interesting because it's like that probably translates almost immediately when you look at live performances. Oh. You know what I mean? Like that's like one of those things where like immediately it just levels things up. Because 100%. It just like, it knows that you have such a like an attuneness to what you're doing and how everything, and it's such a fun little dance.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like this, and it's fascinating. It's honestly fascinating. But kind of landing the plane here with our last section. I want to start off by saying thank you. This conversation has been amazing.
Thank you.
And I think there's plenty of insights and actionable things that someone that is getting into music or even just consuming it. I think this is, you know, a good window into, you know, how you view things and like your perspective on stuff. And I think it's really refreshing. And I do appreciate that a lot because the attitude and the character and the way that you carry yourself is it's inspiring and it creates hope for other people.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, thank you.
But when you look back at your body of work and everything that you've done, is there specific milestones that you kind of like you want to be, I don't want to say remembered by, because like I feel like that's so like crude, or like remembered by as if like you're passing or something. Like it's just weird, right? But like something where when people look at you, is there anything that you've been most proud about?
Wow. I think there are a couple things. I don't think there's, because
as many as you want
bragging, but I've done a lot.
Yeah.
And that's just for me applying myself, which I always tell artists to like make the most of your day, you know? Hip Hop for Hunger is one thing that I'm extremely proud of. What Paul DeGlive and Music for Mavericks were able to do in a sense of giving Edmonton hip-hop community an opportunity to give back and show that they actually can galvanize in a way that helps. I think that's something that, and then just the platform that we gave to Edmonton hip-hop artists to be seen at a time period where hip-hop wasn't necessarily the biggest thing in the city, but there were so many people who loved it, you know? So that in itself, the opportunities that were provided, the food that was raised, when I look at the mentorship that I've done with various artists, being able to pass on to them what was passed on to me from Don Joyce, Kata Pinnock, countless other people, that is very rewarding. There is no Arlo Maverick without Paul DeGlive. Like Bigga, Gritty, Sonny Grimes, like I've spent so many countless hours with those gentlemen. Creating and having fun, and like every opportunity we get to be back on stage performing, like I relish in it because I'm just like I'm back to being a kid again, you mm-hmm. know. And I think that Wow. It's tough. Filmmaking, the ability to document stories and have stories that most people weren't aware of. Like when we did the cricket documentary, people were just like, I never knew there was a cricket scene here in Edmonton that had West Indian players, you know? And
you did something about breakdancing?
Yeah, we did something about the breaking scene, which is the foundation for...
This was the Unbreakable Crew?
Untouchable Crew.
Yeah.
That in itself was an amazing experience. And so, yeah, it's hard to... Even CJSR, like, it's hard to pin it down to just one thing because there's been a lot of things that I did just because they needed to be done. I used to be a journalist. Yeah. And I don't have education as it relates to it. I just knew there was a void. There was something needed to be done. And so I did it. And was I good at it? I'll leave that up to other people to decide. But a job needed to be done, and so I did it. No different than you realizing that there are stories that are not being heard. And you're like, I want to sit down and have a conversation with this person, you know? So I know I'm speaking in a very roundabout way. Just because I think it's very hard, but I think if there's anything, I would have to say that for Politic Live, Hip Hop for Hunger, we impacted families and communities in this city in a way that, and we did it collectively as a city. We provided the vehicle and the city came together. As Arlo Maverick, I'm going to say just my mentorship. I think that's the biggest contribution that I've made, the one that is going to have the most long-lasting impact. And it also branches out to so many different things, you know? So whether it's me mentoring artists on grants or how to create an album or how to become more business-minded, like all of that is creating, hopefully, sustainability for our ecosystem.
And before we let you go, what do you have coming up in the pipeline now? What are you really locked in on now, and where can people find you?
There's a brand new album, tentatively titled The Office. It was supposed to drop this year, but we're still tweaking a few different things. It is the follow-up to Blue Collar. So it extends the conversation of the working class, but into the office space. And so it tackles more issues, and I think will really allow for things to go full circle in the sense of that conversation of the people in Alberta and this province who work, you know. And then more film projects, and hopefully continuing to make Edmonton a spot that people want to come and discover music, culture, so on and so forth.
Very nice. Very well said. And where can people find you online?
Okay. You can find me at youtube.com/ArloMaverick. You can find me at Arlo Maverick on Instagram. My Twitter account, I've been locked out of that for like probably 5 years. So don't try to find me there. Yeah. TikTok, I'm on there at Arlo.Maverick. I got locked out of my first one. So it's not Arlo, not at Arlo Maverick. And then Spotify, title, SoundCloud, just put in the search for Arlo Maverick. My music is on there. Really dive into the albums. As you probably have noticed, like, there's a lot of time that goes into those albums. There's a story that that each album centers around, and hopefully people will become fans or be interested enough that they're like, I like what I hear. Let me see what it's like to see this guy on stage.
Yeah, for sure. Maybe we see a reunion tour of Politic Live here coming soon.
That would be nice.
Yeah. With that, that concludes episode 70 of Solo Spotlight with Arlo Maverick. Be sure to check out his latest album, Blue Collar, and the rest of his discography. All of the links to his social media, as well as his platform, will be in the description below. Show him some love. Check out his music. Let us know in the comments what song you like the most. Have you seen him perform live? What are you excited for? What are you excited for coming from Arlo Maverick? And don't forget to like, subscribe, follow our channel, Spare Bedroom Studios, as well as Solo Spotlight. And we will see you next week. Thank you very much.